And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. Boy, it's cold out there today. Don't be fooled if you happen to be looking out the window whenever we've got bright sunshine. There are times when we've had snow showers and snow squalls, too. But it is a really, really cold day out there. Temperature itself is in the upper teens, but there's quite a wind today, and pretty brutal, pretty brutal. Hey, we have a good show lined up for you. I think we're going to be talking about aircraft, jetliner cabins and seats and all that sort of thing. The airline industry has really been changing over the past decade or so. We'll be chatting in just a moment or so with Jennifer Coots Clay about jetliner cabins. A little bit later on the program, we'll be chatting about PBS Kids, Public Broadcasting System, PBS. Sarah DeWitt will join us. And we'll also be talking about problem kids. My child is different. Kids who are over-anxious or who act out, who are very angry. What do you do with them? How do you help them succeed in school? Elaine Hannigan will have some advice for us. So all of that coming up on the It's Your Turn program today. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll talk with Jennifer about jetliners and airline seats. It's all coming up next. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Folks, you talk about tradition. You realize Miller's Shoes has been in downtown Butler for well over 120 years now. Yeah, that's tradition. That's staying power. Miller's Shoes, your headquarters for shoes for all members of the family. If you're looking for athletic shoes, they've got them for men, women, teens, kids, and they've got all the famous brands, too, right there under one roof. Miller's Shoes has Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, Pro-Pet, and more. Athletic shoes for the whole family. They've also got Rockport shoes and Trotters and Hush Puppies and many other famous name brands as well. Easy Spirit. And they're your local headquarters for America's favorite comfort shoes, SAS. You'll find them for men and women in a variety of styles and colors at Miller's Shoes. You can always count on that great Miller's fit, too. And a friendly smile from the Ciprians. Miller's Shoes. Headquarters for shoes for the entire family. 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Miller's Shoes. Hey, folks, have you heard about Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center? Yeah, they're located just off Newcastle Road, Shockey Lane, right behind King's and Villa Grande. Going Postal Butler. They package your items for shipping. And that takes care of a situation that sometimes can be a real bother. You know, you got to get the wrapping paper, the string, the tape, whatever you need. They'll do it for you. And you can ship any way you want to, FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service. They will package your items for shipping at Going Postal Butler. Other services they offer, copying, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, custom boxes. They have an official notary, also greeting cards, even a lottery agent. Going Postal Butler, 140 Shockey Lane. That's just off Newcastle Road, right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants. It's in the Shockey Mini Storage Area. For more information, give them a call, 724-841-0044. Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Coming up on It's Your Turn here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. We're going to be chatting with the guest, Jennifer Coots Clay, about jetliner cabins. How about that? First of all, Jennifer, hello. Nice to have you with us here today.
Yes. Hello, Dave. It's great to be with you.
You've written a book called Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. I guess I've never thought about that, but it seems pretty obvious that jetliner cabins have evolved over the past few decades, have they not?
Well, yes, people talk about the glory days of flying, but these days it's a miracle, really, when you think that 4 billion passengers are in the air within 1 year on the world's scheduled airlines. That's the figure that came from International Air Transport Association for the year of 2017. So, yes, we're all flying these days. And the cabins are central because the passenger impact relates to the time the passenger spends inside the cabin. And that's why I wrote my book. I think this is a wonderful subject, but I've been in the aviation business now for well over 30 years, and I've worked on cabin design, development, marketing, operations, and so this was the main reason for bringing out my book. And it still seems this is the only book on the subject.
Have you worked for British Airways or some other airline in Europe, Jennifer?
Yes. I spent 16 years at British Airways. BA is my alma mater. That's where I was trained. I was the first woman operations manager in British Airways. I was the first woman to run a territory based in Los Angeles, West USA. And I ran Scotland. I was head of Scotland for British Airways. And I was controller corporate identity when the airline changed from government ownership to private investor ownership.
I had one of the best breakfasts I've ever had on a Brit airplane.
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear about that.
I would have thought I was sitting in a fine restaurant somewhere. I mean, I had eggs and bacon and everything. It was unbelievable.
That's the way it should be. It's not always like that, but I'm delighted that you had the great breakfast, the great British breakfast, they call it, yes.
Now, the title of your book is Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. I don't know how far back you go. Jetliners came into vogue, I believe, for mass transit only in the early 1960s. Do you go back any further than that, Jennifer?
No. In fact, I really start at the end of the 60s when the Boeing 747 was introduced. It was launched in 60, it was rolled out in 69, and first commercial flight was at the beginning of 1970. So I do refer sometimes to the Boeing 707, the predecessor of the 747, but mainly my book focuses on the early 1970s up to now, the A380, the A350, the Boeing Dreamliner 787, and the other new generation aircraft.
Well, the Boeing 747 was certainly an incredible innovation. Number one, it was the first plane, to the best of my knowledge at least, that had a second deck, right? A partial second deck.
That's right. And in fact, one of my most recent published articles is a description of the upper deck of the 747. And Pan Am pioneered that treatment. You see, a number, particularly the pilots and a number of employees, thought that upper deck would be a crew rest area. And the head of Pan Am, One Trip, who was a formidable chief executive, said, "This area is going to be for passengers." And in my article, I explain how they had a cocktail lounge there with 16 seats for 16 people. And subsequently, they installed upper deck dining, which was a really grand affair. It was all arranged in advance. The passengers had name cards at the table, and they served roast beef. Passengers could say, oh, they wanted well done or less well done or thick slices or thin slices. And they carved the roast beef up there. And this was a wonderful product innovation. And really, during the 70s, this was probably the most talked about product in the civil aviation world. Passengers used to book way in advance to be sure of getting a table in the upper deck for the luxurious dining.
Was that a first class? I've flown on 747s many times, but it was never in the upper deck. Was that a first class expensive portion of the plane?
Yes, it was related to what they call the A zone. That's the section of the aircraft closest to the nose mm-hmm. of the aircraft. And so passengers essentially got two seats for the price of one. When they paid for their fare, they were getting a seat on the main deck, plus provided they made their reservation in advance, and that was necessary because of ordering food, of course. They would get this lovely seat in the upper deck, initially for the cocktail lounge experience, but later it was turned into the grand upper deck dining. And my articles in Aircraft Interiors International magazine show the pictures, the vintage pictures, from Pan Am, provided by the Pan Am Museum Foundation. What I didn't mention was, Dave, at one time I was general manager product design and development at Pan Am, based here in New York City at the Pan Am building. So I know about all these pictures, and I have the measurements of the cabin and the upper deck, and so I was able to write these articles with quotations from people who actually worked in the 747 aircraft in those days.
Now, I have no training or experience other than flying occasionally, but it seems to me that once the 747 kind of reached its peak, there were significant changes when we went to such planes as the Airbus 330, actually a little bit smaller. And that had to do, did it not, with the fuel economy? Because the 747 has four humongous engines, and yes. the newer models, the Dreamliner by Boeing, the Airbus 330, they're just two engines. So they're much more fuel efficient, right?
Right. And in the late 1980s, this was another pioneering program by Pan American, and I was involved personally. The Airbus A310-300 pioneered what they called ETOPS, extended twin operation, twin engine operations over the Atlantic. And so here's the A310-300, two engines. And the aircraft interior is smaller. It's carrying over 300 passengers instead of carrying well over 400 passengers, which was the situation with the Boeing 747 on the Atlantic. And yes, the upper deck had disappeared, of course, so passengers were on the main deck, and they only had one seat instead of having two seats.
Still a lot of people, though. 300 passengers, that's a lot of people. Now, there's one huge exception, and I think I've got the right number. I've never flown on this plane. Is it the Airbus 380? That is a complete upper deck plane. There are two levels the whole way back the plane?
That's right. Nose to tail, two levels. So they call that a double-decker aircraft. In fact, it's a triple-decker because underneath those two levels, you've got the cargo section. And some people have said, oh, well, look, they could put a lounge, they could put a gym, they could put a creche, they could put rest facilities into the lower cargo section. So right now it flies double-deck. And yes, that's a big aircraft, right?
Have you ever flown on it?
Yes, I've been on the Lufthansa A380. It was a wonderful experience for such an enormous aircraft. It's very quiet, and of course, for the long flights, you can get up and walk around. The length of the A380 cabin from nose to tail is longer than the very first flight by the Wright brothers.
Now, that is fascinating. That really is.
Well, I mentioned this in my update to Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation, because we brought out the updates relating to 2018. And the flight distance, the Wright brothers, 120 feet. And the cabin of the A380, well, it depends whether you're counting the galleys and the wardrobes at the nose and the tail, but that's something like 130-something feet. So there we are. We can walk around in the A380, and we can walk a longer distance than Orville Wright flew with Wilbur running alongside him on the very first flight at Kitty Hawk.
Now, what about, because I've read reports that, especially in recent years, airlines have been making the seats smaller, the individual seats smaller, and putting the rows closer together. Is this actually true, Jennifer?
Yes, and the reason is that airlines are dealing with real estate. It's a bit like a hotel or a department store. They need to get the best yield from every usable inch of space in the cabin. Now, some airlines are reducing seat pitch below the normal economy class seat pitch, if we're talking economy class, traditionally 30 or 31 inches. But some airlines, and in fact over the years, have flown with 29-inch pitch, 28-inch pitch even, and that is squashed. It's like being in a sports stadium or in some sort of cinema even. It's okay for maybe an hour or two, but particularly for people, North Atlantic travelers, after an hour or two, you get very cramped. What they're doing, they're changing the seat foams so that the foams are not fat the way they used to be. They used to be easily 3-4 inches thick. Now the foams are probably, these are the foam cushions that are underneath those seat covers, probably around 2 inches now, the modern ones, and they have reshaped the structure of the seat so that passengers can get their feet under the seat in front of them in a more comfortable way.
Mm-hmm.
Some airlines are restricting the recline on the seat back so that the passenger in the row in front of me doesn't push his seat back and hit me on the knees when I'm trying to, you know, drink a cup of coffee or look at my computer. They can restrict the recline, and then they're contouring the seats in a different way so as to provide more lumbar support at the sides of the passengers instead of those flat panels. So there are improvements, but yes, it is typical. The airlines do try to get as many seats as possible inside the aircraft. That's what the business is all about. And we have to look at the fare levels. Again, as I quoted in my update, according to Airlines for America, the average round-trip airfare USA, adjusted for inflation and including ancillaries, it's 40% cheaper today than it was in 1980. So that's what happens when the seats are all pushed into sardine row configuration.
Mm-hmm. Get more people in there. There are some changes, though. I know days gone by, if you were making a transatlantic flight, you always had a small pillow and a blanket on your seat when you boarded the plane.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case anymore. You got to pay for that if you want it nowadays, right?
That's right. In economy class, the airlines have stripped out a lot of those extras and accessories. One, to reduce weight on board the aircraft, meaning using less jet fuel, and that means a lower level of carbon emissions. The other point is that people arrive these days festooned with neck cushions and blankets and, you know, teddy bears and all sorts of things. What we found in the aviation business was that passengers were taking their own steps to do what they wanted to do inside the cabin. Of course, in business class, the premium cabins, business, premium economy, first class, when the airlines offer more than just economy class, you'll still find blankets, amenity kits, headrest covers, cushions, socks, eye masks. Economy class, you're quite right, passengers tend to bring their own comfort items these days.
Have jetliners always had overhead bins, and have passengers always haggled over them?
That's the point I mentioned in my Boeing 747 articles. Here we have the first closable bins when the 747 went into commercial service at the beginning of 1970, first flight from New York to London. And passengers were thrilled because, you know, they were able to kind of earmark or grab a bin that related just to their own seat row. And so the bins have become bigger and bigger over the years, because nowadays people bring in these rollerboard suitcases. Some of them, you know, look a bit like sort of miniature tanks. Amazing. Whereas earlier, for instance, back in the days of Concorde, the overhead bin was large enough for a document portfolio and a hat, but not much more than that. So overhead bins have turned into a selling point, a product feature, and airlines are very proud of the fact. For example, the new Airbus A220, which was formerly the Bombardier C-Series, they have space for everyone on board to bring in a rollerboard suitcase stacked on its thin side, all the way pushed back to the outer edges of the aircraft. So this is a big subject these days. And, of course, this is great because putting these carry-on items above your head, it means you've got the space below the seat in front of you so that you can stretch out your legs.
Mm-hmm,
and
exactly.
Therefore, the passengers will be far more comfortable.
You mentioned the Concorde. I can remember the first time I ever saw one. The Concorde never flew in and out of Pittsburgh International, where we live, but I saw one at JFK. I was on the taxiway. I was in a, you know, humongous 747, and we taxied past Concorde. I was shocked to see how small it was. It almost looked like a toy down there.
Yes, more like a private jet, like general aviation. Well, I've written a lot about Concorde because I worked personally on Concorde when I was at British Airways. I mean, with my own hands. We put on the grey leather seat covers back in 1984, and that was wonderful because we launched this business look specifically for the transfer from government to investor ownership. And those seats, believe it or not, are 17 inches left to right. And that is considered a small seat on economy class these days. In the early days of the Boeing 747, the seats were 18 inches wide. And so the Concorde seats were always lovely. In BA, we never had complaints from people about the seats. Now, they were at 38-inch pitch. You could stretch out your feet. They did recline a little bit, a couple of inches, but the seats were ergonomically contoured at the sides with this lumbar padding and headrest shaping, which I do show in my book in detail. And passengers love those seats. If you go to the Intrepid Museum here in New York City, you'll see Alpha Delta, the Concorde, on the ground there. You can see it from the George Washington Bridge. And there are lovely tours inside, and you can sit into the seats. You can even go into the cockpit and sit in the pilot's seat. And everyone says, these seats are lovely. Now, that's the result of this very careful treatment of the cushioning foams and the shaping of a seat which is only 17 inches wide. My shoulders are 16 inches wide, by the way. And so I'm just giving that information, you know, to explain that the seat is not a great big fat seat, but but it's an extremely comfortable seat.
Yes, close quarters and going very, 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 very fast. Do you think we'll ever return to supersonic transport? The Concorde,
yes.
Of course, out of business for many, many years now.
27 years Concorde flew, and that's the average length of time for an aircraft model. Everybody who relied on Concorde, and we're talking about the top echelons of the business community on the Atlantic, they were desperately unhappy when Concorde ceased operations. So I'm sure we're going to see supersonic again. Already there are programs by Aerion, Spike, Lockheed, and it's only a matter of time. So for the long distances, given a choice on the Atlantic of 7 hours or 3 hours, 20 minutes, which would we choose? So the market is there, and I'm pretty sure we're going to see the development in the next generation.
Our time begins to run short. I have to ask you one other question. It may not be in your bailiwick, I'm not sure, but a lot of people complain about when they're, you know, after they board the plane and they're sitting there, they're waiting for pushback or taxiing or whatever, that is so hot. It's my understanding that you can't run the air conditioning when the plane is on the ground. Am I correct on that, or what's the deal?
Right. What they do in those circumstances, they try to conserve or energy, and they try to reduce all activities that are not central to the matter of pushing back and preparing for takeoff. And different airlines have different policies. And so it's a question of the airline being extremely economical during that waiting time when some airlines don't even allow the use of reading lights during that time. So what they're doing, they're just focusing on the central activity, the cockpit systems, and the ancillary systems. They cut down and they don't use the ancillary auxiliary power units. They cut out everything else only to focus on the essential activities for pushback and preparation for takeoff. So it's the airline being economical and being careful. Now, if this lasts a long time, it's really uncomfortable. If it's only for a short little burst, we're talking minutes, many of the passengers don't even notice that because they're busy getting out their, you know, reading material, they're busy adjusting their seat belt, they're busy chatting with each other, looking out through the windows. There's plenty to do, you know. But it is true, when that lasts quite a long time, particularly in hot weather, and a large part of USA does have hot weather for a large part of the year throughout the summer, and of course the aircraft gets hot. So, yes, that can be very uncomfortable at the time.
As we wrap up here today, I understand there's a new e-book app now for your book, Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. Am I right on that, Jennifer?
Yes, and this is available, well, there's the website, jetlinercabins.com, and the book is available via Amazon, Apple, and Google for the different screen devices.
I have been fascinated by air travel for my entire life, and Jennifer, I must say, I could talk with you for a couple of hours. This has just been most interesting.
Well, thank you. I'd like to send you a copy of the e-book app, Dave. I hope you'll enjoy reading it.
Oh, please do. I would really appreciate that.
Yes, yeah. We will definitely sort. We will make sure. And I hope your next air journey will be a happy bon voyage.
Well, thank you for that. She's the author of Jetliner Cabins, Evolution and Innovation. She is Jennifer Coots Clay, and she's been our guest here on It's Your Turn. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
Sure.
I was just 49 when I started getting mail from AARP. AARP? Shoot, I was just getting started in life. Then I hit my 60s and retirement was on my mind. The big question was, did I prepare? What about healthcare? Are my finances in order? Not just for my wife and me, but for the kids and grandkids. I got the answers I needed from attorney Michael Pater, specializing in elder law, long-term care, Medicaid, and wills and estate planning, is attorney Michael Pater in the Handicap Accessible Morgan Center. Phone 287-7724.
Handling grief is tough and lonely. After the loss of a loved one, who can really understand how you feel, how grief affects your life every single day? Well, Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique sensitive program called Someone's Caring. It's meticulously designed to help ease your emotional pain and help you fill in the gaps when you're lonely. Men and women are invited to attend. Yes, men too are realizing it's okay to express their feelings in a small group setting. Over the last 20 years, we've helped so many people work through their grief. We have five programs, a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of a suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a pet, and individual sessions. Our own trained and bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller, conducts each session personally. Call us at Thompson Miller, 724-287-3706, 287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Coming up, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn, we're going to be talking about high-tech devices and what they might mean for kids. Our guest, we're chatting with her on the telephone, Sarah DeWitt. Sarah is the Vice President of PBS Kids Digital. Well, Sarah, we're deep into the winter months now. Families spending a lot more time indoors, a lot more screen time. A lot of people worry when the kids are, you know, having a lot of screen time. But, you know, you say if you got good content, it can be very good for kids, right? Right?
Right, right. It really is all about the content. That's what makes all the difference, as well as thinking about when kids are playing with it and what context, what kind times of day. If you think about what a child is really interested in the real world, so like my four-year-old is really into animals right now, if you can find digital content that connects with that, that actually can help them learn a lot more. It's playing off of their interests. So we've been playing games at home from the Wildcrafts on PBS Kids that is all focused on animals. And what that means is now when we are on the floor playing Cheetah Family, he knows some more facts about how a cheetah runs and how fast they can run and what kinds of things they eat. So trying to make that connection between the real world and some digital time can actually be a really good educational benefit.
There are some new gadgets for kids. Parents may not be aware of them or may be unfamiliar with them, but these are, I guess, specifically designed for young people as opposed to, you know, like a standard tablet or something?
Well, no, actually, the number one gadget for kids still is a standard tablet. This holiday season, same thing. Tablets really are really good for younger kids in particular because kids can jump right in. It's big enough that their motor control, they can kind of swipe all right. But I really like them too from the parent perspective because that screen is big enough that you can walk by your child while they're playing and see what they're doing. And so you have a little bit of insight in what they're playing, and that means when the kids are done playing, you can ask them some questions about what they just played. Like, how did you make it through that level that looked really hard? Or what did you feed that animal to get it to calm down? You know, it gives you a chance to have a conversation with your kids about the media, and that's setting up a really good media habit in a family, that media screen time is something that you talk about, something that you share about, and something that you can actually help think critically about. What would make that better? What did you like about that and what didn't you like? Kind of setting this up as something that is a shared experience as opposed to something you just do by yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see the point about the larger screen being able easier for parents to see,
yes.
What,
mm-hmm.
see what's going on. Well, what about safety? I mean, gosh, we're talking about, in some cases, young kids here. You know, and they might come onto something that would be totally inappropriate for them. Any tips for parents there, Sarah?
Yes, definitely thinking a lot about the content you choose to let kids play with. Lots of these new gadgets do have parental controls. They vary so much from gadget to gadget that I really recommend coming up as a family on some screen time rules. So one is that parents can kind of establish what are the games you can play with and what are the places where you can play. For younger kids, downloading apps that don't then connect out to the wider internet is giving you kind of a safer space. Also setting up one screen on the iPad, you know, you can swipe through screens of buttons. Setting up one screen that's all of the apps and games that you would like your kid to play with and saying you have to stay within the screen. Another thing is to help teach kids what to do when they do stumble across something that, you know, makes them a little uncomfortable that they know isn't for them, how to turn it off quickly, and then to tell their parents about it. CommonSenseMedia.org is a great resource to kind of help parents navigate the app stores. It gives you age targets, but also will let you know whether or not there's anything violent or inappropriate in an app, and also whether something's going to be pushing in-app purchases on kids or violate any kind of privacy rules.
Did you say that was CommonSense.org? Was that the website?
CommonSenseMedia.org.
Ah, thank you. CommonSenseMedia.org. Are there really studies, scientific studies, that show that digital content can help boost a child's learning?
Yes, there are. There's been some really interesting studies over the last few years. We have some of them aggregated at pbskids.org/lab, L-A-B, like laboratory. Some studies have shown that if kids are playing with a game over time, that it actually can improve their math scores or help them with something like building more empathy. So games are really versatile right now. They can teach kids all kinds of different things. One finding that I think is really important for parents to understand is, and this is consistent in all the research I've seen, is that if a parent has a conversation with their kids about what they played or what they watched, the educational gains are going to be greater. So just that little bit of conversation can help the child better recall what they did and what they played. But then I think there's another benefit. It sets up a nice bonding moment between the parent and the kid. It's fun to talk about games and shows together. And so that gives you some shared moments and also gives you a better understanding of what they're doing.
Boy, I'm shaking my head here, Sarah DeWitt. I'm a baby boomer, and my memories of that are like climbing up on the sofa with my mom for a little golden book. You're probably too young to know what I'm talking about when I say
no. I have golden books. Yes, and that's also a really great thing to be doing. It's the thing is, the parents should remember is that screen time shouldn't take away from reading together. From playing board games together, for going on walks together. Screen time is really pervasive in our world right now. Kids are seeing it all the time, and we want to help kids understand it so that they are growing up with good habits to navigate technology as they get older. But kids still really need to be kids. They need to be able to play on the floor. They need to be able to read with their mom or dad. So trying to think of it as one other activity that fits into a kid's life is a good way to approach it.
Good advice on the gadgets and so on. Let's talk about one final thing before we wrap up here, and that's free resources that are available from PBS Kids. Some of our listeners may not have heard of PBS Kids, Sarah.
Well, PBS Kids is an educational media brand, nonprofit media, public broadcaster in the U.S., in Pittsburgh, you watch PBS Kids on WQED, but we have the PBS Kids Games app is the one that I really would love people to know about. It has over 100 games that you can even download them and take them out of Wi-Fi if you need to go on a plane ride or something like that. And those games are all tied to different educational goals. And they also feature all the characters that kids are used to watching on TV. So the Wildcrats and Daniel Tiger and Dinosaur Train. So lots of fun games there. We also have a great new game called PBS Kids for Parents Play and Learn Science. And it's for preschoolers and parents to play games together that help them explore different scientific concepts. And what I really love about it is it's always giving the parent a tip or an idea of a hands-on activity you can do away from the screen. So how do you take this learning now into the real world? How do you help kids see that the science they played with in digital is something that actually is in the real world too and ties to something they might be learning in school? So if you'd like more tips or resources, you can follow PBS Kids on Facebook or on Instagram. We're regularly putting out articles about screen time, tips and ideas for parents about how to navigate it, as well as announcements when we launch new apps.
Sarah DeWitt, Vice President of PBS Kids Digital. Thanks, Sarah. Good to talk with you today.
Good to talk to you, too. Thanks so much.
Sure. So long now.
Bye.
I'm a big believer in community medicine.
Meet Dr. Richard Begg, the newest member and clinical leader of the Butler Health System cardiology team.
People like to be taken care of where they live. The closer you are, the closer the relationship. So there's a real loyalty to Butler Health System. That's something people in the region have invested in for a long time.
For more than 20 years, our cardiovascular center has brought world-class heart care to the heart of our community. Today, we're building on that strong past to ensure an even stronger future.
Most everything you would find in a larger health system, you'll find right here. People with cardiovascular disease are showing the ultimate trust in us. And we don't take that for granted. We work to earn it every single day.
At Butler Health System, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Did you buy a car, truck, or SUV last year thinking you were going to get 0% or some other low-rate finance offer and then drove off the lot with a much higher rate? Don't worry. Armco Credit Union has the solution. Refinance with us and get a 60-month loan on a 2016 or newer vehicle for just 2.24% APR. We've got low rates on older models, too. It's never been easier to join, so call any of our four branch locations today or visit us at armcocu.com for membership and rate information. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federal. Insured by NCUA.
Welcome, listeners, on the segment of It's Your Turn that's coming up here on WISR. By the way, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Elaine Halligan. She joins us by telephone from England, believe it or not. And we'll be talking about her book, My Child's Different. First of all, Elaine, welcome. Gosh, nice to talk to you long distance here today.
Just lovely, because I'm sitting in my office here in Wimbledon, SW19. It just seems surreal to be talking to you in Pittsburgh. It's great to be here. Thank you, Dave.
Wimbledon, that's the home of the All England Lawn and Tennis Club, right?
It sure is. Have you been here?
I have, as a matter of fact, yes.
Ah. It's good fun. It all changes in June.
once when I was
little village all changes.
It was in the summertime. It wasn't during the tournament, but I was in London, and I was determined that I was going to see center court at Wimbledon. So I got on the tube, and I got off at the wrong tube station. You would know this, of course.
Oh.
There's a tube station called, at least when I was there, there was a tube station called Wimbledon, and there was a tube station called Wimbledon Park. And they were right next to each other. And I didn't know which one to get off, and I got off on the wrong one. I ended up walking, like, I don't know, 2 miles to finally get to the All England. But I did see it. I was there. I was at center court.
That's your claim to fame.
Well, that's another story for another day. It's delightful to talk to you about your book. My Child's Different. Subtitle is The Lessons Learned from One Family's Struggle to Unlock Their Son's Potential. So your son Sam, right?
It's my son Sam. So the book is a true story. It's a human interest story about Sam, who's, by the way, now a young adult. But it tracks his life, and he had a very tricky start to life, Dave, because he was expelled from 3 schools in so many years by the age of 7.
Wow. Wow.
So by the age of 7, he was written off in society. He became known as the alphabet kid because of all the diagnostic labels that were attributed to him. And I would say his sense of self-worth was completely shattered. And the book kind of helps other parents and tells them what they can do to help kids who are different, who are difficult. They may be atypical learners. They may be a bit neurodiverse. Sam. He was severely dyslexic, but it took us a long time to work that out. But the book tells you how you can help your child develop into a thriving, resilient adult. Mm-hmm. And it's about, gosh, it's about maximizing all our children's potential and unlocking strengths.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of parents wondering if there is, in fact, a way to respond to the behavior of a challenging child. It helps them manage their anger or their anxiety or whatever. Is it a little unusual to see this as young as 7 years old, though?
Not at all. I think the signs were there, actually, when Sam was three. And when Sam was three, we would often be met at the nursery by the teacher, who would say, "We have had a tricky day." It was always the royal we. And it was, "Sam's not listening, he's not concentrating, he can't sit on the carpet, he pushes other children, he's distractible, he needs constant attention, he's high energy." So actually, I think the reality is many parents kind of sense that their child is different. But what happened to us is when I spoke about my concerns to friends and teachers, that the same response was resounding. It was, "Oh, he's a boy." Yeah. This is just what boys are like. He's high energy. I then got told, "You're worrying about nothing. Oh, it's just age and stage of development." But deep down, Dave, I just knew something wasn't quite right. And of course, everything came unstuck when he landed in his first primary school and lasted 1 year and then was asked to leave. So I think tricky behavior presents itself actually quite early on. And what we do as parents has a huge impact on what happens next.
So how quickly did the labeling process begin? Was this after you began to seek professional help for your son?
After the third exclusion, then the labeling started, because then we were sent along to the hospital to meet psychiatrists and psychologists, and we just got a plethora of what I call three-letter abbreviations, TLAs. Mm-hmm. And we were told he's on the autistic spectrum. We were told he has sensory integration dysfunction. We were told he had ODD, which maybe your listeners know as oppositional defiance disorder. And the day we were told he had PDA, and PDA is not public displays of affection. it was pathological demand avoidance. And that was the day I just came home and I wept. And I wept because I felt exhausted. I felt completely overwhelmed. And I guess I felt very guilty because I got things wrong. And I was angry because Sam wouldn't listen to me, and I just didn't understand him, his temperament, or his educational needs. So it was a really bad time in our lives.
Did you have other children, or Sam an only child?
Yeah, good question. We had Izzy, and she's 3 years younger. And, of course, when Izzy came along, what do all parents do when they have siblings? They compare.
Sure.
And Izzy's development was completely different. And I kept thinking, oh, my God, it's not right. But when you have your first child, you do not know what's normal. And so when Izzy came along, it was much easier to kind of see, there is something very different about Sam's development. And that's when we started seeking some kind of diagnostic assessments. The labels he had, there was a hodgepodge. It was like having a kid in the syndrome mix. And really, it took us a long time to deduce that actually a lot of Sam's behavior was caused by anxiety, extreme anxiety, because he was being placed in an educational environment where the work was way too challenging. And that was because of his severe dyslexia.
Well, let's talk about some of the advice in your book, the title of which, again, listeners, is My Child's Different. What are some of the key things that parents should look for as they're beginning to consider enrolling their child in a nursery school or a preschool or something like that?
So I think when you're enrolling your children in school, maybe the first thing to look for is just a warm, empathetic, compassionate environment that just seeks to understand children and allow them just to be creative problem solvers, yeah? And not focus too much on education, because, at play is a child's learning at nursery school. And I think we are kind of embedded in an education system where we're so keen on success, we kind of lose sight of what our role is. So that would be my top tip, is just to look for an environment that really treats all children uniquely. And as they start primary school, again, don't be so obsessed with academic achievement, but look for some of the softer skills that are just as important in our kids to enable them to be creative. We do want them to be hardworking, but it's, I would say trust your gut, trust your instinct. But it's very difficult when you don't know what your child's educational needs are. And that was our issue. We did not know what Sam needed.
We're talking to Elaine Halligan. For those of you who may have joined us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, we're talking about her book, My Child's Different. One of the things you talk about in your book is raising a child's self-esteem. I have always thought it terrific when I go into visit somebody's home where they have young kids and the refrigerator, I don't know whether they do this in England or not, Elaine, but the refrigerator is covered with the latest artwork by the child or the children or the latest spelling test or whatever they are. They put it on the refrigerator door with magnets for everybody to see. I always thought that was great for a kid's self-esteem.
Isn't it? Because it's a positive environment. It shows the child that mom and dad care.
Yeah.
It shows the child that mom and dad show an interest. But actually, if you want to raise children's self-esteem, there is one trick that is incredibly powerful. And that is using a skill called descriptive praise. Have you heard of it?
I have not, no.
So let me explain how it works. Inadvertently, in society, we can be quite critical. We don't mean to be, but we are. And as parents, we have something called the negativity bias, which is we just tend to notice often what our kids get wrong. It's very tempting when little Harry comes in from school, hangs his coat up, does the right thing, he hangs his coat in the right place, and then runs through but dumps his shoes and backpack in the middle of the floor. What do we notice? We comment on the shoes and the backpack, and we say, Harry, how many times do I have to tell you your shoes don't live in the middle of the floor? And we berate and we say, it's not difficult. I've set up a shoebox for you. Why can't you just put your shoes away? And it's interesting because part of our brain, which is called the reticular activating system, it searches for whatever it is we're currently focused on. And we may be focused on having a tidy house. So that's what we notice, is the shoe's not in the right place. And we filter out other things that we think, they're not so important. So inadvertently, what we end up doing is not praising the good behavior. And we spend more time commenting on the bad behavior. Yeah. And it's really simple. We get more of what we pay attention to.
Great idea.
So, our in the example I gave you,
go ahead, please, go ahead.
So I was going to say, an example I gave you, it's really simple. You just say, Harry, thanks, you've done one of the three things you need to do when you're coming from school. Your coat is in the right place. I wonder which thing you're going to do next.
Good idea, yeah.
And so it's a clever technique to get them thinking for themselves without us nagging, repeating, and reminding. And when we start noticing more of what our children get right, they get more motivated. And guess what happens to self-esteem? The more we comment, the more self-esteem goes up.
There we go. Our time begins to run short. I want to ask you about how parents can cope when their child acts out in public. That's a little bit different than acting out at home, but acting out in public, a real problem, eh, Elaine?
Oh, my God. We have all been there. I don't know whether in the book you remember my LPM. My LPM was my lowest parenting moment.
Yes.
And it was on the train, and my child was kicking another passenger. Oh, my God, I did everything. I berated, I criticized, I punished, I scolded him, I told him to stop. And, of course, everything I did led to more rebellion and resentment. So when your child is acting out in public, the first thing I would say is don't punish. There is always a reason for behavior. And children acting out in public, it means their emotional backpack is overflowing. And in that moment, the only thing we need to do in that moment is take action to help themselves calm down. In other words, to self-regulate. And it could be using our words. It could be naming their feeling to tame it. But whatever we do when they're acting out in public, if you berate them and criticize and punish, you will see worse behavior. So a quick example, you're really cross with me for not having bought you that sweet. You absolutely wanted that sweet, and you're probably feeling upset that you had your sweetie allowance already today. You are really mad with me. And the funny thing is, when you recognize a child's feelings and put a name to them, they often look at you and they start to calm down as they realize that mum and dad absolutely understand. Then when you get back home, can you start problem solving and working out how can we set things up so that this behavior is less likely to happen? It may be that there's a rule missing.
Elaine,
it may be that we needed to use the power of our words. Sorry.
Elaine Halligan, yeah, we just have a little bit of a delay here because we're talking. Elaine's in London, in Wimbledon, and I'm here in Western Pennsylvania, so a little bit of a delay on our satellite feed here. There are other things that Elaine discusses in her book, My Child's Different, including how to help your child if he struggles with written exams or tests. What are some things you can do there? And lots of other stuff as well. Just a quick note about our guest before we let her go. Elaine Halligan is a director at the Parent Practice. She has been a parenting specialist since 06, and she appears on Sky News. That's a big cable outfit in Europe, also on the BBC as well, too. Elaine, what a delight to talk with you today. You have some wonderful tips in your book. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure, Dave. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. So long now.
Bye-bye.
Time for a checkup for your pet. We recommend Suburban Animal Clinic. Or maybe Fido or Tabby is not feeling so well. Suburban Animal Clinic, a small animal veterinary practice located Route 8 south of Butler at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. It's about 5 miles south of Butler. Suburban Animal Clinic, in the spirit of Dr. Dennis Damon. Their services include wellness checks for your pet, of course, also emergency care. They have laser therapy, dental available, also prescription diets. You know, one of the things that are problems for a lot of our pets these days, being overweight. Microchipping, they can handle that as well. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, south of Butler. If you're headed south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on your left. That's Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Music is a bridge between the material and the spiritual. My name is Harvey Lauer, and I'm 82. As a blind person, you have to be aware that nobody can tell you what you can or can't do. You really have to try things. My folks got me a little radio in 1940, and that was the best Christmas present I ever got. When I was 11 years old is when I started to play music, play the piano, and then the accordion, and then the cello. My wife, who was also blind, was a good cook. When she died, that's when I started Meals on Wheels. America, let's do lunch.
One in six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at AmericaLetsDoLunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 1230 to 130, right here on WISR 680.
I need love.